Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. According to the National Institute of Health 2022 fact sheet, more than 20 million people in the United States were diagnosed with substance use disorder in the past year. Add to that that 70% of children who try an illegal drug before age 13 develop a substance abuse disorder within the next 7 years. That's compared with 27% who try an illegal drug after age 17. Quite staggering. And I share that because my guest today is Judy Mandel. Her niece, Cheryl, struggled with addiction and all that goes with that from a very early age, including prison, shelter living, and ultimately a fatal overdose. Judy Mandel drew on her investigative skills as a reporter to try and understand Cheryl's life and what went wrong and where. And the result is her latest memoir, White Flag. It is deeply personal. It must have been excruciating for her to write this, but I'm glad she did, and I think she's glad too. Let me tell you a little bit about her, and I'll bring her right on. Judy Mandel is a former reporter and marketing executive. She has an MFA in creative writing from Stony Brook University, and her essays have appeared in numerous publications, including American Writers Review and Complete Wellbeing magazine. She's the New York Times bestselling author of Replacement Child, and her second memoir is White Flag. And here's my guest, Judy Mandel. Judy Mandel, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So before you wrote your first memoir, which was Replacement Child, you were a journalist and marketing writer. And then at some point you felt to tell more personal stories. So tell us how that transition came about, if you would.
Sure. So, you know, I was always writing in some way, you know, starting in reporting for a newspaper, actually the Hartford Courant in Connecticut here. And then I branched out into public relations. I worked at a hospital, and it was always writing. And then in marketing as well after that. So I think it really started when my parents passed away. And I finally looked at an envelope that my mother had left me of newspaper articles and her notes and the newspaper articles about the plane crash that crashed into our house. This is before my birth, in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and killed one of my sisters and badly injured my other sister.
Wow.
So she had tried to write this story again and again. You know, there were, you know, loose leaf papers in this envelope that she just kept trying to write the story. And after she passed away, I know she gave them to me because she thought I would write the story. And I was really, basically, I was the only one left to do it and decided I needed to do it.
Yeah, and she being your mother left you all of this information. That's an incredible story in itself, isn't it? And what a thing to live through and to lose a child, you know, horrific experience. But your second book was also compelled from a not a great experience. You had a sister named Linda Sue, and on her deathbed, you promised that you'd look after her girls, one of them being Cheryl, who you lost touch with. But what is it that made you at this point want to write White Flag? And I heard you say that you just were compelled to write it. You had to write it. You had no choice.
I think that is true, that I had to. You know, White Flag was a different story for me to write. And I have to say it was more difficult, even emotionally more difficult. You know, my niece, this is Linda's, I love that you called her Linda Sue because that's what I called her. Her middle name, but Cheryl, who's the person I write about in White Flag, is Linda's daughter. And so when you say, I promised Linda on her deathbed, I did. I said, don't worry, I've got your girls. And so it was a responsibility for me. It felt like a responsibility. And sadly, Cheryl suffered from substance use disorder, and I lost track of her for 2 years. I couldn't find her. I didn't know where she was, and I was very concerned. I really thought she might be dead. She'd either be on the street or she was dead. And then I found her, and she was in prison in Ohio at that point.
Yeah, that must have been quite a shock for you. A relief in one way, because at least you're still alive, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Immediately a relief. The mugshot I found online, which was a new thing that you could do. You know, I could never find people before that way, but it was all of a sudden you could find people with mugshots. So I did find her. I found her, the number, her prison number and where she was, and I wrote to her. And that started, we were back in touch again, which I was also very relieved about. My thought was, well, at least she's safe, and she's, hopefully not using while she's in prison. Right. I mean, you don't always know that, but it seemed to be the case. So we opened up the communication again, which I was grateful about.
Right.
So actually that's where my book starts, is with that opening.
Yes.
Of that communication.
Yes.
But after she did pass away from an overdose, and I'm sorry to give away the part of the book, but can't be helped. but after she passed away, I didn't think I would be writing anything, to be very honest with you. But I always save things, because I'm a writer. So I always save, I call it evidence, actually. Whatever. If I'm ever going to write something about something to do with it, I wanted the pieces of whatever it is, whatever event is happening. So I did have her letters, and I started going through those. And the letters I wrote her, I had kept those. And, I just started going through those. And then I did get hold of her journal that she had, which came with her effects, with the clothing that they had to cut off of her in the emergency room. So I was going through that. And then I did get a hold of her cell phone from the hospital. And I could look at the texts that she was sending the last couple of weeks of her life,
mm-hmm.
and to put together some of those pieces of her life as well. And before I knew it, I was sitting down and trying to make some sense of it by writing, which is, I guess, the only way I know how to do it.
Right. So tell us a little bit, you've got some photographs in the book of Cheryl when she was young, like most children, beautiful smile, full of hope,
Right.
Who knows what's lying ahead. What was she like as a child, and what changed? At what point did she become an addict?
Yeah, well, she did start using drugs very young, in her, early teens. At that point, people didn't look at the reasons that somebody might be using drugs. They treated the symptoms, which I believe is what it was. Nowadays, they look at what they call dual diagnosis, and they look at what is the reason behind the substance use disorder, and then the substance itself. So there's two prongs to it. I know she was sent to rehabs, very early in her life. I don't think they did any good. The ones that she went to, I know she went to one in Colorado that I believe is questionable. Kind of a tough love, wilderness type of place.
Yeah.
And, from what I've read, those were questionable. And, you need to research where you're sending people. I'm sure that, my sister thought that was a good place. Somebody said that this was a good place and did it. And in any case, she did start very young, which is another another problem for people with substance use disorder. If you start very young, it has more of an effect on your brain. The brain chemistry starts to change at a very young age in that way.
Yes.
And it's hard to fix it.
Yeah.
To make it plain language, it's hard to, not that you can't, and you certainly can, and there are ways, you know, that you can get into recovery.
No, the brain is a very powerful tool. I mean, we've done several shows, you know, focusing on various aspects of the brain, and it's a very powerful tool. And, you know, one of the things you just touched on this lightly, but I just want to step back on it, and that is how we treated things and how families are not raised to really spot addiction or how to deal with it. I mean, how well equipped did you feel to cope with it when your sister died and you're left with the responsibility of caring for Cheryl?
Right.
You know,
right.
It's a learning process all around. And, you know, I've seen many of those shows, and I've actually talked with producers and interviewed some of the people who've gone through it on that show called Intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And watching that makes you realize just how out of control they are. They really don't have control. And so people who want to do that tough love and, you know, pull up your socks and quit, it's, yeah.
No,
there but for the grace, right?
That easy. You know, the metaphor that always sticks with me is the one talking about, you know, they know they're careening off a cliff in a car and they're putting their foot on the brake, but the brake does not work.
Yeah.
And, I actually think of Cheryl that way because I know she wanted to recover.
Mm-hmm.
I know she wanted to. She made efforts to. And there just wasn't the right kind of help for her. And in some ways, and this is why I named the book White Flag, she did not raise her white flag and want in surrender to it that I need help. You know, I need help to overcome this.
Yeah.
Or recover from this.
But that's the brain chemistry taking over, right? Because the brain wants to keep...
I believe it is.
You know, they have this craving and they just want to keep taking. And, you know, it's a horror when...
It's chemical. You know, levels of dopamine and dopamine receptors and how they change. And I believe they need medically assisted treatment now, you know, with Suboxone, you know, the buprenorphine that now is used along with counseling and help with, you know, social services.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when my niece got out of prison, there was nothing. She couldn't get a job. I mean, she got menial jobs, nothing that could support her. She couldn't get a bank account. It was, you know, you need help.
So let me ask you this then. So you're trying to navigate all this yourself, of course, trying to figure things out.
Right.
Where did you start and what did you find helpful?
Well, we were very far away. I'm in Connecticut, and she was, at that point when she got out of prison, she was in Kentucky. We talked about her coming here. That was one thing that I guess I'll always regret that I didn't do. But she didn't, when I originally wanted her to come, she didn't want to come, which was right out of prison. You know, toward the end of her life, she then said, oh, well, now I want to come. And I couldn't figure out how to do it. I couldn't figure out how to keep her health care and get her, you know, get her a job, get her situated, get her help. And so I tried to do it remotely where she was. I'll tell you, the only place I could find when she was homeless, the only place I could find her a bed, and this was another white flag reference, was when it was very cold in Louisville, the Salvation Army... they raise a white flag. You know, it used to be a real white flag. Now it's a digital white flag and will open to anyone, you know, because it's too cold to be on the street.
Right.
And that's where she did find a place to stay toward the end.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that about that white flag symbol. Yeah. And yeah, one of my questions is why did you call it White Flag, and you've answered that, so it makes perfect sense.
Well, there's another piece to that, so let me tell you that the other piece is my own White Flag, and at some point I had to, you know, surrender to the fact of what I could and couldn't do for her. So it's kind of a three-pronged reason I picked that name.
Yeah, because as much as the addicts need treatment, the families also need help. People around them, they have to set firm boundaries and learn that acceptance, right? It doesn't just affect one person.
And the boundaries are difficult because they will lie and cheat and steal. And, I found out from her text messages she was lying to me, you know, almost every day about what she was doing. And, you know, it was one reason that she didn't come and live with me.
Mm-hmm.
I was worried about that. So yeah. That was a boundary that I put up. And, you know, people have to find those boundaries while still letting them know that they're loved. I think that's the important piece.
Yes, definitely. There's a great quote in the book that you share by Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, "I'm not upset that you lied to me. I'm upset that from now on I can't believe you." And that's the one thing when we talked about addiction before, is it's not them lying per se, it's the drug lying per se. And that trust thing is, once it's gone, it's gone.
What meant a lot to me when I was interviewing someone who used to be, used to have substance use disorder, but it still, said they were, it's still in recovery. They always say that. And she said to me what meant most to her was that her mother told her she was not her addiction, that she was more than that. And that really meant a lot to me to hear that. I think that's an important message.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of second guessing around any situation like this. I mean, not just substance abuse, but any kind of, family emotional turmoil, I think. And one of the things I think we're really good at, of course, is being geniuses in hindsight. And you said that when you were researching for White Flag, you went to Louisville, where Cheryl lived, because you wanted to understand her life there, even though she had now passed. And as you walked across a parking lot to pick up your rental car, you say you heard her whispering to you, "Now you come. Why didn't you come when I needed you?" And I'm imagining there must be a lot of that whispering going on, after
the fact. Yeah, absolutely.
And how do you deal with that?
It's a difficult piece. And, it might be something that I always have, feeling of what I should have done, what I could have done. But and also in the research that I did, I came to understand the complexities of this disease, and I was ill-equipped to understand and to do the things that she needed, and in many senses, it was not accessible. The treatment was not accessible where she was. It wasn't accessible where I am at that point. It's getting better. And people are understanding more that, with medically assisted treatment and counseling and not arresting people and putting them in jail is more of an answer than throwing people in prison.
Yeah. Well, you write that for many years, having an addict in the family that felt shameful, and that shame stopped you from telling friends about your niece, Cheryl. But at some point, when she was in jail, you did start talking about it to people. Did that help? And I'm guessing you were pretty judicious about who you talked with.
Yeah, I really did kind of screen people to know how they might react. It is definitely a stigma. I mean, not just substance use disorder, but then someone in prison, it's definitely a stigma. But the people I talked to, social worker friends and people, who are psychologists. And I remember actually the first person that I mentioned it to when I was at a conference, and she was a social worker, and she said to me, "You have to put money in her commissary," at which I hadn't even thought of it. I hadn't even thought of what I should be doing in that case. And she said, "You have to." She told me some things. You mm-hmm. have to. And you have to call her, and you have to do this. And, that would make her feel that somebody cared about her, and she was right. She was certainly right about that, and I'm grateful to her to have told me that.
Right, right. And that trip was driven by an intense longing to really know the reality of Cheryl, because you needed to know at that point who you were mourning, you said.
Yes, that's very true. I wanted to see, you know, I wanted to go to the Salvation Army shelter and see, you know, where she had been living. And I found out that they had much more services than I had any inkling that they had, that she could have and should have taken advantage of and didn't. So, you know, very eye-opening in that way. You know, there was, I went to visit the Jewish Family Services, which I had sent her to, and you know, they were very nice and, you know, understanding, but they actually did not really help her. It was during the holidays, and nobody was around. Mm-hmm. You know, this was like when the crisis happened, which I'm sure happens for many families around the holiday season. You know, the staffing is light. People are on vacation. They're not, you know, not as helpful as they could be. So, you know, the accessibility of treatment was an issue. But you're right. I wanted to see where she was. And boy, you know, there are parts of Louisville that are really very nice and parts that are not. I mean, it's just like any city in that way.
Right.
I wanted to go to the park where she was last. I wanted to, you know, see the picnic benches where I thought she was found. You know, I had some coordinates that, you know, from the ER that they had said where they found her, and it happened to be by a dog park, and I knew that's where she would sit and watch the dog, because she loved animals. And so I picked one of the benches to see kind of the view. I wanted to see where she was, you know, like mm-hmm. her last view. It meant something to
right.
me.
Right. Well, I have a friend who says this all the time. Why learn to cope when I can just live in denial? And there are many situations where many of us kind of take that route. At some point, we might have to man up and learn how to cope. But I think there is a lot of denial around any kind of substance abuse. And I'm wondering, you know, as you're traveling and meeting people and doing your research, what's the most common stories that people tell themselves about family members when they're in denial that there's a problem?
They'll say, if there is a problem and they don't want to, you know, acknowledge it, you know, they'll say, oh, well, they only use on the weekend, you know,
yeah.
or, you know, it's not really a problem. They still have a job, you know.
Yeah.
Go to their job.
But there's
it's not a problem.
A lot of functioning yeah. addicts, though, right?
Right, functioning. But, you know, the other thing is that I was just thinking is, you know, when someone does have substance use disorder, you don't want to acknowledge it because it reflects on you. It's still a stigma.
Mm.
It's, you know, what is wrong with your family that this happened? You know, somebody else might be talking to. Well, I don't have anyone in my family who, you know, has this problem. But the more you talk to people, the more you realize everybody has somebody in their family.
Yeah, they do. And you know, I know somebody who. I can't say too much, but I know somebody who has a relative. Every time I've seen that relative is as high as a kite. Nobody around it notices it. It can be 7 o'clock in the morning and that person is bouncing off the ceiling and their eyes are glazed, but
oh my gosh,
nobody notices it because that person has a professional job. So, you know, going back to that denial
situation. For now.
For now, yes, exactly. And I was looking at statistics this morning, and they're not good. They're going up. We certainly in America have not got control of the situation. They estimated that over 50% of Americans tried some kind of drug during this year. Things are not improving, it seems.
During COVID, it got much, much worse. Overdoses spiraled in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And, you know, just like, you know, mental illness. I mean, people are looking for help. There was a lot of isolation. You know, people were not in the regular jobs they were in. They're working at home. You know, the kids were home also. And certainly, you know, young people, it has it has really been an issue.
Yeah.
The past few years.
Yes.
So hopefully there will be some changes, and you know, that's, I am hopeful about that. There'll be some legislative changes, that people will get help instead of prison, that treatment will be more available than the drugs. I think that's an important piece.
Yeah.
And understand it. And people, I guess this is, you know, when I think about, you know, why I really wrote this book, it's so people look at their loved ones not as an addict, you know, not as that person, but the same person that they always loved.
Yeah.
It's the same person. They're not their addiction, as my friend would say.
Yeah, and if you've known somebody who is very heavily addicted, seriously addicted, and then you see them after recovery, it's like looking at a different person.
Oh, yeah, they are.
Health-wise. So, you know, it's a health issue as much as anything else. So I'm wondering, you know, as a writer, how difficult this was for you to put it together? Because it's one thing to think, I'm going to write a memoir. This is a story that, you know, should be shared. You know, it might help other people. And I, you know, want to tell Cheryl's story and your journey with it. But it's another thing to actually sit down and put it on paper and release it into the world. What was that like for you?
It was hard. I won't lie. There were a lot of tears writing this, but even every time I had to edit it and proofread it, it was hard.
No, I can imagine.
Because you relive and you go back into the time period. You know, this book is filled with her letters, and it's filled with her, you know, her journal entries and
picture of her dog and her Facebook posts.
All her Facebook posts.
Yeah.
Pictures, and so it's diving right back in every time I did. The first piece that I wrote that I felt I needed to write was when I got the call that she was at, University of Louisville Hospital and in the ER, and they called me, and strangely, I was watching the Women's March after the election, and so this was January 2017, and I got the call, you know, with unknown caller on it, but it said Louisville, Kentucky, so I picked it up. And they asked me if I was Cheryl's niece, Cheryl Vance, and, you know, that she was in the hospital, that she thinks she was going to make it. And so I wrote about that call and how awful it was.
Mm.
And it was one of those pieces of writing that, you know, you just cry through the whole writing of it.
Right.
There's no way out of it, but I needed to write it. It felt like I had to get it on the page.
Right.
And after that, I started, as I said, collecting evidence that I, you know, putting things together, trying to put the pieces together, trying to understand. You know, I had a lot of questions. And the usual questions, you know, why did she use drugs? Why couldn't she stop? What happened? The usual questions that everyone asked.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel found resolution? Do you feel you found resolution around that, or are there still questions still pending?
I feel like I understand it a lot better. I don't have all the answers. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a psychiatrist. But the brain chemistry answers helped me a great deal. Understanding transgenerational trauma, especially in my family, with a plane crash that badly injured her mother, who really went through trauma her whole life. There's no way that doesn't filter down to a daughter. There's no way. So understanding those pieces and the complexity of it, it has actually given me some peace with knowing more about it.
Right. And Cheryl's not here, obviously. Did you find yourself censoring anything in her memory when you were writing? Or did you want to tell the whole story as you found it?
Well, I wanted to tell the whole story as I found it. My only hesitance was because of her sister. And we hadn't been talking to each other. I was worried about how she would receive this. And, you know, finally, she has read it, and she's fine with it. We've talked, and we're actually closer now than we probably ever have been. So I didn't want to hurt her. I think it's more important not to hurt the live people. But she wanted the story told as well, it turns out. So I tried not to censor anything. I tried to tell it. I mean, you know, I found out about sexual abuse when she was a child. I think that had much to do with her depression. There were a lot of tentacles to this. They're important to understand.
Yes, and, you know, reading the book, I mean, you certainly sound, you know, very open and very honest there. And I know as a writer myself how difficult it can be to open up. As I said, it's one thing, you know, scribbling something in your journal. It's a whole other thing putting it on a page and releasing it into the world, because you kind of lose control of it after that, too. Yeah. And so you're going around now talking about it. And what I know you've said, you know, this is your piece, your contribution. But what do you really want to leave us with today? What do you want to leave listeners with today?
If they have a loved one who has substance use disorder, let them know that they're loved and be there for them in any way that you can. Keep them alive until they're ready to raise their white flag and ask for help, and then find them the right help. That's what I would like to leave people with.
Well, Julie Mandel, I really appreciate you being with us today. The book is called White Flag, and I know listeners can find out much more about you at your website, judymandel.com. And I really appreciate you being with us.
Well, thank you so much, Vicki.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.